From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The strongest Southern California earthquake in 20 years keeps on giving. Potent aftershocks have been plentiful over the past 24 hours. The 6.4 magnitude quake follows two decades of relative quiet. We'll get an on-the-scene report from epicenter-adjacent Ridgecrest and details about the fault area responsible. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you had a terrific 4th of July yesterday. Maybe you're even off today, taking a long four-day weekend. All the better. But it's a pleasure to be back with you today. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Film Week. Really anxious to hear about this new Mexican film, The Chambermaid, which has very strong word of mouth. We'll hear what our critics have to say about the film. We also are going to open up the phones for you to talk about the increasing usage of illegal fireworks, which has become a more recent Los Angeles area tradition, with fireworks going off in some neighborhoods all night long. We'll talk about what you like or don't like about that, and talk about the efforts, which don't seem to have gone very far, for LA authorities to crack down on it. But first, the largest earthquake to shake Southern California in two decades is producing plenty of aftershocks, some over five on the Richter scale. Yesterday morning, 6.4 magnitude quake was centered near Ridgecrest in the Mojave Desert. KPCC reporter Emily Guerin is there and spent the night in Ridgecrest. Emily, thanks very much. Did you get much sleep with the aftershocks going?
You know, I was doing okay until, like you said, around 4 a.m. when the mirror started rattling and the door started rattling. And I woke up and realized I had not yet located the closest desk or table to jump under. So I sat up and I did that very quickly. And by that time, the shaking stopped. But there were a few other aftershocks afterwards, including, Larry, about 5 minutes before I started talking to you all on Air Talk, there was another one that shook the little plastic chandelier of the hotel lobby that I'm working out of right now. So the action is continuing.
Wow. One of the things I remember from the Northridge earthquake and living fairly close to the epicenter was the disruption in sleep that went on for weeks afterward with all the aftershocks. And I know we're only 24 hours, not even quite 24 hours past the quake, but is this something that in your conversations with residents, they've talked about the difficulty of even getting rest?
Yeah. So this morning I went out to this this sort of spot on Highway 178 east of Ridgecrest where you can actually see cracks in the road. And I was talking to a man named Paul Mayberry who lives here in town. And I mean, he said he barely slept at all. And so I think that, you know, he would have been awake either way, but the aftershocks definitely helped keep him up. And he said it's just this sort of sense of not knowing when they're going to happen, not knowing how bad they're going to be. I mean, some of them, you know, are quite strong and some of them you barely feel. And so I think it's that uncertainty that's hard.
Yeah, I certainly understand. So you went out to where the ground rupture is. Describe it for us.
Okay, so it's about 9 miles east of Ridgecrest, and the rupture crosses State Highway 178. And yesterday, some road crews patched the crack, and I don't know if it reopened this morning with the new aftershock, or maybe they just didn't get to all of it. But there were a number of new-looking cracks across the road that were, I would say, like 2 or 3 inches wide. But what I found more impressive was when you went off the asphalt and into the dirt on the side of the road. I mean, the crack just went straight like an arrow for kind of as far as I could see. And in some places it was quite wide and deep. Like I shoved my arm into it and it went up to my shoulder. And in some places it was more shallow and it looked like someone had just come along and kind of kicked the surface crust to the side a little bit. So there were a lot of people out there taking pictures, you know, wanting to sort of see physical evidence of the thing that they had been feeling these past 24 hours.
And are you aware of any damage to Highway 395, or does it look like it's confined to that ground rupture separating asphalt on the 178?
That is all I have heard. And I have not seen any damage to streets in town. There have been, I mean, at least yesterday, a lot of streetlights were out. there were some power outages. I know a lot of people lost water in their houses. But I think that that one particular state highway, 178, is the only one I've heard of that's a state highway that has any damage.
We're talking with KPCC reporter Emily Guerin, who's in Ridgecrest, close to the epicenter of yesterday's earthquake that struck just after 10:30 in the morning. What's the extent of property damage in the Ridgecrest area?
What extent of property damage? Well, it kind of, you know, I think it also depends. Some people said that they, you know, their cabinets open, the first layer of dishes fell on the floor, refrigerators open, you know, it was kind of a sticky mess in the kitchen. One man I talked to said his toilet kind of like hopped to the side off of, you know, where it's mounted to the floor, and that he has some cracks in the drywall. But I also talked to people who, you know, it was much more minimal, like water sloshed out of their pool and a few things fell off the walls, and that seemed to be it. So there seems to be a pretty wide range. I haven't talked to that many people yet who have had, like, structural damage to their house. I've heard that some of the mobile homes may have been damaged, but I haven't seen that personally or talked to anyone. But definitely a lot of broken things. And a lot of people spoke about broken valuable things. One man said he spent all morning putting family heirlooms into a trash bin. So that's pretty sad.
A couple of fires that we'd heard about and at least partial evacuation of the hospital in Ridgecrest. Right. Have you gotten any more details, Emily, on what concerns at the hospital led to that evacuation?
So from what I can tell, the hospital administrator did it out of an abundance of caution. Part of their hospital is newer, and he said had not yet been through an earthquake, and they just wanted to make sure that everything was safe and sound. I believe he said they were calling in some sort of seismic engineer to do kind of a checkup. They did have some damage in the hospital, though, like water breaks, some glass broke, a few people were cut. So my sense was that it was more out of caution than out of any, you know, severe damage that had occurred.
All right. Before I let you go, I know you're talking with a lot of people out there trying to get a sense of the effect of the initial quake and aftershocks on Ridgecrest. But anything just to add before I let you go?
Well, I have to say, Larry, this is my first earthquake as a Californian. I was in one before when I was much younger in northern Chile. And I think what's so interesting to me is everybody feels it differently. I mean, some people described, you know, what was this most striking to them was the noise. Like this one man described it as a deep, low rumble that sounded like a freight train that he couldn't see. Other people described, you know, just the sort of like chaos of things falling and the fear of not knowing how long it was going to go on. And that's what I felt. I mean, when the aftershocks happen, it's like, you look around, you make sure there's a table nearby, and then you're just like, you don't know how long it's going to last. So you just sort of have to control the things you can control and try to let go of everything else.
Emily, thanks so much. We appreciate it. And we'll look forward to your coverage throughout the day right here on KPCC.
Larry.
Thanks. Emily Guerin, KPCC reporter, who's been in Ridgecrest about 20 hours now, reporting on the aftermath of yesterday's earthquake. And as she just said, another aftershock felt in Ridgecrest just a few minutes before she started talking with us. Also with us from the University of Southern California, Professor of Earth Sciences, James Dolan. Professor, good to have you with us again.
My pleasure, Larry.
Well, let's talk about the faults that are in this area. Is it too early to determine exactly which fault was the one that slipped?
That particular area is exceedingly complicated. It's sort of the juncture between two major fault systems, sort of the southern end of the Owens Valley fault system, which extends along the eastern front of the Sierra Nevada. And the biggest fault in Southern California that most people have never heard of, it's called the Garlock Fault, and it runs almost at right angles to the predominant fault fabric out there, which is most of the faults in what's called the Eastern California Shear Zone, which is a shear zone that runs through Eastern California. Geologists are notoriously unimaginative when it comes to naming things. Those faults extend sort of north-northwest. And they are what are called right lateral strike slip faults. That means motion is horizontal in earthquakes. And if you're standing on one side of the fault, everything on the other side of the fault will appear to move to your right. It doesn't matter which side of the fault you're on. The Garlock, at almost right angles to this, this is a 150-mile-long fault that extends all the way from Fraser Park near the top of the Grapevine all the way east to the southern end of Death Valley, is almost perpendicular to all these other faults of the Eastern California Shear Zone. And where this earthquake yesterday occurred is just north of the Garlock Fault in a very, very complicated zone associated with kind of the breakup of the Owens Valley Fault coming down from the north. And that's probably related to the fact that just north of Ridgecrest, there's what's called the Coso Volcanic Field. And there's a magma chamber underneath that that still has a lot of residual heat.
Let me just interject. This is visible as you drive on 395.
Yeah, absolutely. You drive along what's called the Little Lake Fault, and you look to your right, and there's about a 200-foot tall escarpment of just jet black basalt. This magma that's come out, this lava that's come out of this magma chamber, spectacular volcanic effects out there, cinder cones, really cool if you've never been up there.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this stuff, but it's just fascinating to see how dramatic the landscape is, the geology is, as you drive along 395.
Oh, yeah, as you drive north, even a little bit further north, you go past something called Red Mountain, which is this perfectly formed kind of bright red cinder cone a couple hundred feet high. Just spectacular.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so this is all interconnected.
Absolutely. As this, so what happens as the faults of the Eastern California Shear Zone come into this zone of, magma at depth, they kind of break up and turn into this, you might almost call it a fault mesh of orthogonal faults, what are called conjugate faults, where we have both faults that are parallel to the Garlock, east-west, and faults that are parallel to the main faults of the Eastern California Shear Zone, sort of north-northwest. And two of those faults, one of each sets, appear to have ruptured yesterday.
Wow. How rare is that?
I'm sorry?
How rare is that?
Well, this is we've seen it before in other earthquakes. It's not particularly common. But another really striking example of where we see similar kind of behavior is right at the southern end of the San Andreas system, where it's in a place called Bombay Beach down in the Salton Sea,
yeah.
And there you have this same sort of checkerboard pattern of east-west left lateral faults and sort of north-northwest San Andreas right lateral faults. And they all seem to be active in that part of Southern California. This is sort of characteristic of areas where the slip hasn't localized onto a single fault strand yet.
We're talking with James Dolan, University of Southern California professor of earth sciences. If you have questions for him about yesterday's magnitude 6.4 earthquake centered near Ridgecrest, the aftershocks that have followed were at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We welcome your questions about this. Now, one of the significant questions, of course, is could there be an even larger earthquake in this same zone to follow? What are the probabilities for that?
Low. Higher than normal, but low. Whenever you have an earthquake, that earthquake is a response to a release of stresses that are stored up in the rock. But those stresses don't go away. They just get redistributed to other faults. Now, when I first heard about this earthquake with the initial location, it wasn't precisely located yet, I immediately started, I hope this isn't the Garlock, because the Garlock can generate a really big earthquake if the whole thing goes, something in the high sevens. Hmm. And this was pretty close. This was about 10 miles north of the Garlock. And it turned out to mostly be on, again, two faults broke, one of which was parallel to the Garlock and the other of which was almost perpendicular to it. Most of the energy was released on the fault that's parallel to the Garlock. So weirdly, it's almost paradoxical, but when you model the stresses that changed as a result of this earthquake, if you have rupture on a fault that's parallel to another fault you worry about, it actually kind of reduces the stresses on the Garlock at that location.
Because they're going the same direction, whereas if they crossed,
exactly,
the chance of that stress to move down to the perpendicular fault?
It's exceedingly complicated, as you can imagine. It's a very, very three-dimensional problem. So this is all done with computers now. It's a very sophisticated kind of computer analysis called Coulomb stress modeling. So we can understand how the stresses are redistributed, but in a lot of cases where you have complicated fault geometries, it cannot necessarily be intuitive, something you can just guess at without doing the computer modeling.
And it's fascinating to me, you did the modeling on this within 24 hours. That's pretty fast to look at the stresses created.
More computer adept than I have. I'm a geologist. I dig holes in the ground.
All right. James Dolan, USC, with us. He'll continue. We'll take your questions as we talk about yesterday's earthquake centered near Ridgecrest, 6.4. Fascinating stuff. And, of course, with tremendous emotional impact and property damage for those who lived close to the epicenter. For those of us that lived in more metropolitan Los Angeles and Orange counties, not as significant an event, certainly, though we felt the rolling motion of the quake. For those sitting on top of it, a very frightening experience for a quake of 6.4 magnitude, plus all the aftershocks that have come over the past 24 hours. 866-893-KPCC, back in 1 minute. Filmweek coming up at 11 here on 89.3 KPECC. We'll hear about a new Mexican film, The Chambermaid, from writer-director Lila Aviles. Also hear about Greg Kinnear's film that he directed and stars in, Phil, about a depressed dentist. But it's a comedy, at least in part. We'll hear what our critics think of that, too. Coming up at 11 on Film Week here on KPCC. Right now, we talk about the past 24 hours after the 6.4 magnitude earthquake centered near Ridgecrest in the Mojave Desert. USC Earth Sciences Professor James Dolan is with us. We were just talking about the Garlock fault, which was not engaged with this earthquake, but you were saying is capable of quite a large magnitude earthquake. Professor, does this increase the odds at all that Garlock could have an earthquake? I know you said the fault was parallel to Garlock. That was good news, but does it potentially increase the likelihood of an earthquake on it?
Well, there's sort of an axiom in earthquake science is that earthquakes beget other earthquakes. Again, when you release the stress in an earthquake, it's just redistributed to other faults. So this is anytime you have a significant earthquake, and 6.4 is a good-sized earthquake, near a big fault that has been sitting there for a long time. The most recent earthquake on the Garlock was about 500 years ago. It's always cause for concern. Now, the Garlock is the fault that's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And again, most people in Southern California have probably never heard of it. Yet it's an enormous fault. The most recent earthquake probably generated something in excess of 20 feet of lateral slip.
Whoa.
So it was probably a high 7. It's capable of generating very, very large earthquakes.
And that could cause significant damage in Kern County, LA County. That would be a region-wide event.
Yeah, well, anytime you start talking about really big ones like that, you know, sort of San Andreas scale big ones, it is a regional event. Obviously, it would be very serious for local communities like Ridgecrest, which is just, you know, 10, 15 miles from the Garlock, Mojave, Tehachapi, even Bakersfield farther west. But the real concern is that the Garlock is sort of sympathetic to the San Andreas in that it tends to go when the San Andreas goes and vice versa, although the Garlock doesn't go every time the San Andreas does. So there are potentially, however unlikely, there are potentially triggering phenomenon where a big Garlock earthquake could trigger a big San Andreas earthquake.
Where did they intersect?
Fraser Park, which is basically just at the top of the Grapevine, that's a really, really interesting part of the world right there. The San Andreas runs right through Gorman, if you know where Gorman is.
Oh, yeah.
And as you go over the summit sign right there is literally you're crossing the San Andreas Fault. There's a bunch of white rock in the road cut. That is the damaged gouge zone of the San Andreas Fault you're crossing.
I know the white. Yeah, you see it really clearly when you're taking Interstate 5, the Grapevine there. And that, as I recall, you said that's the western terminus of Garlock?
No, it's just a little north of that. So San Andreas continues for another couple of miles before, and then you come over the ridge and you come down. If you're going northbound, you come down and there's Fraser Park in front of you. It's on the hill on the other side of the valley, and just to your left is where they intersect.
All right. James Dolan, USC Earth Sciences professor with us. We've had so many listeners ask, you know, does this increase the odds of the San Andreas? If the Garlock Fault doesn't engage and cause an earthquake, could yesterday's quake still have an effect on the San Andreas?
Well, we never say never, but there are no, I mean, it's far removed from the San Andreas. The stress changes associated with this earthquake on the San Andreas were tiny. So there's no obvious cause and effect relationship at work here, but we just have to remember, it's been since 1857 was the most recent big one on the San Andreas. On average, and that's an important word, on average, that part of the San Andreas, just on the other side of the hill from Pasadena, produces earthquakes, big ones, about once every 100 years. All right, so it's obviously been over 160 years since we've had.
We're behind, yeah. Is that the Fort Tejon quake you're talking about?
Fort Tejon. No, we don't use the word overdue because we don't really understand the physics of the system well enough to say when a fault should break, should in air quotes. Because it's much more complicated than that. It's not like clockwork. If it were, I'd be out of a job. It's more complicated than this, but the bottom line is it has been a really long time since the most recent San Andreas earthquake. That quiet and just the general seismic quiet we've had over the historic period in L.A., because other than the 1857 earthquake, we haven't had anywhere near enough earthquakes to release all the energy we're storing up, particularly on the urban fault network right underneath our feet, or the Raymond Fault, you know, a half mile south of your studio there. This quiet is going to end eventually. We've been in a quiet period. Eventually it's going to end. It doesn't mean it's going to end tomorrow or 100 years from now, but eventually we have to pay the piper. We know we've been storing up more energy than we've been releasing. Eventually that's going to have to get released in future earthquakes.
And James, final question before you go. The composition of the soil, of the ground generally, where yesterday's earthquake occurred, is it significantly different than what we would find in the ground material closer to metropolitan L.A.?
Conditions out there, China Lake is a dry lake bed, and parts of that area are on lake beds. If there is shallow groundwater, those can be problematic. Having said that, we have problematic places here in L.A. too. This is a complicated issue. The ground, the type of ground you're sitting on top of, exerts an absolutely fundamental control on how strong the ground is going to shake. You can be on bedrock, you know, firm bedrock like up in the San Gabes, exactly the same distance from an earthquake, and you can be out on a weak sediment-saturated site, I mean, water-saturated, weak sediment site, just same distance from the earthquake, just a few miles away, and it can shake 10 times more strongly. So this is an absolutely fun. These are called site effects, and it's a very, very complicated issue. We don't have time to do it now, but it acts as a basic control. So there are good places and bad places.
Yeah, I've gone through both. I've lived on that sedimentary alluvial fan and experienced quakes on that, and I've lived on bedrock, and boy, is there a difference, no question. James, thanks so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Welcome, Larry.
Thanks. James Dolan, University of Southern California, professor of earth sciences, joining us on Air Talk. I'm also pleased to have with us our own Jacob Margolis, science reporter at KPCC and host of the podcast, The Big One. Your survival guide. Jacob, good to have you with us today.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So what James Dolan was talking about, of course, is what we hear constantly in a theme of The Big One, and that is it's inevitable. We are going to have a significant seismic event that affects metropolitan Los Angeles. We got to be prepared.
Yeah, it might not be today. It might not be tomorrow, but it could be the next day, or it could literally be in a minute while we are on the air, and that would be quite something. And the fallout from it is going to be extreme. So this earthquake that happened out in Ridgecrest area was a 6.4. It was a little smaller than, say, the Northridge quake. The Northridge quake caused billions of dollars of damage, collapsed freeways, started fires, collapsed apartment buildings, killed people. A big one that we talk about in our podcast and that, you know, we're talking about possibly occurring on the San Andreas could do just an unimaginable more amount of damage. And a lot of people will die. Infrastructure will fail.
I want to talk a little bit about what James Dolan was just referencing, how differently we experience it based on the kinds of soil that we lived on, the subsurface area, because, as you said, you can be just a short distance away from another structure and it performs and the earthquake is felt very differently.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look at how the waves from the, from say, the southern San Andreas down near like Bombay Beach, if it started down there and broke northward, how those waves actually, they kind of pass through the mountains. The mountains are a bit harder and they get caught almost in the LA Basin, and the LA Basin will actually, it jiggles like jello, and they reverberate inside that. And so the shaking in the LA Basin will be particularly intense and could be particularly damaging.
We saw this, of course, with the Northridge earthquake, where areas that are more sedimentary, like Hollywood, were particularly harder hit in the areas, you know, on top of the hills. If people were, you know, on rockier, they didn't have as much damage.
It's a huge issue in Mexico City too, which is all on
a lake
bed, basically.
Yeah.
And so you get intense liquefaction down there, and you get just like tear. And then obviously combined with the building code issues they have, you end up with a lot of destruction.
Well, Loma Prieta in the Bay Area, remember the Marina? Well, you're probably too young, but the Marina District there was significant structural damage because that was all built on fill and liquefaction. So the soil became like jello, and the structures just gave.
And that's something that they talk about for a scenario up in the Bay Area. Still, a lot of those areas are built on fill still, and you could definitely see intensified damage because of that. Because they built on that.
I want to talk a little bit about the mental health issues because, you know, just speaking for myself and certainly listeners we talked with after the Northridge earthquake, there was a lot of sleep disruption, stress response that people had, fight or flight instinct that had kicked in, not just from the original quake, but from the aftershocks. Anything from the experts you talked with to help people cope with that, like the folks in Ridgecrest now or those in other communities, should we have another one of these big ones soon?
I mean, definitely consult with a mental health professional. It would be something that if you're really having trouble coping with this and feel very unsettled, especially for a long period of time. You know, I have a cousin in Mexico City who before the earthquake back in a couple years ago didn't understand why everyone ran outside and was screaming and crying as soon as the earthquake alarm went off. And then she went through that and now she understands why, because buildings collapsed and her life was, you know, turned upside down there. And that's could be the same feeling of kind of helplessness that maybe people, I don't know, maybe even in Ridgecrest could feel after something like this. Besides that, the very practical, besides consulting with a mental health professional, a very practical thing to do would be to prepare your earthquake kit. Go buy water, 1 gallon of water per person per day. Go buy some food. Have all your medical documents printed out. Have all anything else that's important that needs to, if you need to file with FEMA or something like that, insurance, anything like that, have that printed out and also on a thumb drive. I mean, it's important to prepare because when you prepare, and my sister told me this yesterday actually at our party that we had, she said when the quake hit and the shaking started, she was scared, but for the first time in her life, she knew what to do after. Because I had obviously talked about it.
Yes,
with her so
I'm
many
sure
times.
You did.
Yeah.
One other little thing, this quirky thing with me, when I get like a third of a tank of gas down, I fill up because I always think about if a major earthquake hit, you're not going to have access to gasoline because the pumps probably are not going to be functional because power will be out
and that was
for
an
extended
problem.
Period.
And that was a problem over where the quake hit yesterday is that gas wasn't. I saw an interview with a gas station attendant who basically said that, we've shut down the pumps because we don't know if it's safe. And that's why you should always keep your tank above half full. I am very guilty of not doing that. I drive pretty far every single day, but it's a good thing to do because you never know
Because you're stuck. Yeah, you're not going to get gas for
and
maybe days.
And roads might not be accessible, so you might end up walking. So it's always good also to keep in your car some sort of emergency kit and water as well, which I do. I have good walking shoes.
All right. Sounds good. Jacob, appreciate it very much. Yep. And again, so much more information available on the podcast that you host, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. You can find it at kpcc.org. Thanks so much. And LAist, of course, as well. Jacob Margolis, KPCC Science Reporter with us. Coming up, we open up the phones. I want to hear from you, your experience of the illegal fireworks last night. Do you celebrate it as a very LA sort of expression of patriotism or celebration of the 4th, or do you hate it? Does it bother you, your dogs? Is it disruptive of your life? Have you reached the point where maybe you're going to get out of town on the 4th because you can't take it? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back right after this live update from Julie Slater. The sound of South Los Angeles last night, as recorded by KPCC education editor Tony Marcano. You hear this throughout Southern California now every 4th of July, something I don't recall growing up in the L.A. area. I mean, you'd hear some fireworks, but now in some communities, it's continuous with no quiet for even 3 seconds. My question for you is, do you like how the 4th is now celebrated in Southern California with continuous illegal fireworks? Do you feel it's more festive, more exciting? Do you feel like it's a better way to celebrate? Or do you feel like it's gone way too far, highly disruptive, difficult for your animals? Do you feel like it's so bad maybe you're going to get out of town on the 4th to avoid the cacophony? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me, Executive Officer of My Safe LA, a nonprofit which works with the LA Fire Department and the Community Emergency Response Team. David Barrett, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So there are kind of two major issues here. The one I'm talking about to lead off is sort of the human perception and whether people like or don't like all this. But there are, of course, safety issues involved as well. And can you put the safety part in context?
Sure. Well, there's actually three components to the fireworks issue, and it's fairly complex, right? So there's the policy issue about what's legal and what isn't. There's the enforcement issue, and then there's an education issue. Fireworks in California are broken into two groups, safe and sane, which are authorized by the California State Fire Marshal, and dangerous fireworks, which is really what, on the audio recording that you were just playing, that's typically what you're hearing. The conundrum is that most injuries that occur are from safe and sane fireworks, not from the more dangerous fireworks. So dangerous fireworks, or anything that flies or explodes, those are more likely to start grass fires, structure fires, that type of more significant damage to property.
What's your theory on why?
Well, again, it's a good question, and it's a complex thing. Safe and sane fireworks are typically the things that one hears about, like sparklers.
Piccolo Pete's, things, yeah.
Piccolo Pete's, that sort of thing. Stuff that you mentioned growing up that we would have in our family and engagements when we were kids. Take a sparkler as an example. Sparklers can burn at over 1,200 degrees. Water boils at 212 degrees. Would you stick your kid's hand in a pot of boiling water? Probably not, right? So why are we giving them something that burns at 1,200 degrees? That's exactly why we see that level of injury with safe and sane fireworks. It's because they're more in proximity with children. They're more in proximity with hands, faces, extremities that can be burned and or damaged. So firecrackers, number one cause of injuries. Sparklers, number two cause of injuries.
Fascinating. And of course, you know, the reason that some of the communities allow for the sale of so-called safe and sane fireworks is that the money goes to nonprofit organizations. So in the cities that allow it, Los Angeles not being one, but the cities that do allow it with the stands that are up, they're money makers for those, you know, youth organizations and service organizations within a community, sports leagues and the like. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Ceci in Santa Clarita, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, Larry, thanks so much for all the great work you guys do at KPCC. I'm a member.
Thank you.
I'm on the east end of Santa Clarita Valley, which is called Canyon Country.
Yeah.
It burns within 100 yards of my house every other year. I ran into people who are educators in the cul-de-sac shooting off rockets and illegal stuff and M-80s and bombs and God knows what else. And these are educators. They're teachers in the LAUSD and also up here in Santa Clarita. I don't understand the logic and how they could possibly not figure out that they're going to burn somebody's house down. It's really outrageous. Our sheriff's department is overwhelmed, doing the best they can.
Ceci, did you grow up here in Southern California?
I grew up here, yes.
You did. Do you remember this when you were a kid growing up? Because I mean, I remember a little bit, but nothing like how widespread it is now.
Not at all. I mean, yeah, first of all, people weren't as aggressive with them. You drive down the street, they'll throw M80s at your car. And secondly, they're dangerous. I mean, they're the size of a skee ball. They're huge.
Yeah. Ceci, thanks so much. Appreciate it. And also appreciate your support of KPCC. It means a lot. 866-893-KPCC. Jennifer in Long Beach. What's it like in your part of Long Beach on the 4th?
Right. Hi there. Long Beach is brutal during the 4th, and this is the third year in a row I've had to rent a hotel out of town to take my two dogs because one of my dogs is a cattle dog, hypersensitive, and it just throws her into convulsions. So I have to rent a hotel room in Temecula. I've figured out that Temecula so far is, you know, we didn't hear anything last night, but it's really tough to do for me financially.
Sure.
I have to, because Long Beach I can't even explain how bad it is. And I did grow up in Southern California. I've lived here my whole life and I don't recall it. Every year it seems to be getting worse.
Yeah. It seems more intense every year. Now, Jennifer, what part of Long Beach do you live in?
I am in the Bixby Park area, which is not too far from the Pike area where the Queen Mary is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot just going on. But
yeah, it's a happening place, no question.
You know, it feels that, but one time I just tried to stick with it and stay there for 4th, I felt like I was in a war zone. It was so bad, and I didn't feel just sorry for the dogs. I felt really bad for, there's a lot of vets that live in Long Beach, vet
sure.
veterans. And I can only imagine what those sounds do for the veterans. It must be horrific.
Jennifer, appreciate it. So she goes all the way to Temecula where she rents a hotel room, takes her dogs with her to get a quiet enough place so that particularly her one dog doesn't have a strong reaction. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Dane, I understand you're a lifeguard in Long Beach calling us from Marina Del Rey. So what did you see?
Yes, sir. We saw artificial fireworks as soon as the sun went down, and it's a big problem. They're illegal. We all post signs. We have advisals, and I think that just the police department is way too overtaxed to actively cite or advise the people who are lighting these fireworks. So it's really people can get away with breaking the law in plain sight.
It seems like it's so widespread. I don't know how law enforcement would begin to get a handle on it. As a lifeguard, you concerned about the safety issues of people shooting them off on the beach?
Definitely. I mean, burns and eye, hand, or face injuries are a consideration. But also just with all the wildfires the past couple of years, I'm surprised we haven't seen more brush fires. I'm sure the fire department was working 24/7 even now, because as the caller in Santa Clarita said, there's a huge possibility of starting a wildfire in certain neighborhoods.
Yeah, and in some areas, the illegal fireworks continue into the 5th. They don't stop with the 4th of July. Dana, I appreciate it. Thanks. We're at 866-893-KPECC. And if you're someone who was shooting off your own fireworks last night, I'd like to hear from you. And we're hearing a lot of criticism, people expressing concerns about personal safety, about wildfires, about the noise issue, particularly with dogs that can be highly sensitive to the sound. I want to hear from those of you that do use the fireworks, what the appeal is for you, and if you were confronted by any neighbors, how you dealt with it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. The growing popularity, at least so it seems, of illegal fireworks in the greater Los Angeles, Orange County area. What do you think about it? If you're someone who gets the fireworks, shoots them off, I'd like to hear from you about how you deal with any neighbors who might complain, and also about why that's part of your 4th of July, what you particularly enjoy about the experience. 866-893-KPECC. Tom in Redondo Beach says, I don't understand why the fireworks ban isn't statewide. Well, the kinds of fireworks, Tom, that are being set off are banned pretty much everywhere that I'm aware of in California. The ones that you hear going on all night long, those are not legal. What is legal in some communities are the so-called safe and sane fireworks. That's not what people, though, are setting off the firecrackers and the rockets and all those things. That's David Barrett of MySafe LA. That stuff largely is illegal in the state, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the issue is most of the laws related to illegal fireworks in the state of California are misdemeanors, and they're, with an attorney, pretty easily overcome. So I think it would be really, it's really an important thing to understand why policy is important. As an example, the state law is a $1,000 fine maximum or perhaps a year in county jail. And that's something that can be definitely defended in a number of different ways. Pasadena, on the other hand, has enacted a local ordinance which increases the fine to $50,000 or up to $50,000. And fireworks in the city of Pasadena have declined substantially. So policy is a really important part of the process related to managing the use of illegal fireworks.
All right. There also, this sort of culture of the 4th of July of illegal fireworks seems to have grown. And something that you used to hear just in certain communities has expanded dramatically. Do you think that there's any turning back of the clock to where this isn't just sort of part of the Southern California culture of the 4th?
Well, I think it goes beyond the 4th of July. I'm not sure that it goes beyond the culture of the 4th of July. A lot of people believe that it is patriotic. A lot of people believe that it is a family celebratory activity, right? So people bring all of the family members together. It's also kind of a machismo thing, right? It is typically men, boys, that are actively using illegal fireworks. But it is a demonstration for the family. It is a demonstration, and a lot of people don't have money to go places, and they don't realize or recognize that shows are free, and they want to be at home. So those are all cultural touch points that we're working very diligently on. We teach upwards of 20,000 kids a year about fireworks. We partner with the LAPD, the LA Fire Department, Sheriff's Department, County Fire. This has not happened in the past. This collaboration is only 2 years old. And what we're trying to do is have a uniform message to work hard on education. I will tell you that every school we go to, we count everything, Larry, and 90% of these kids do not know the fireworks are illegal, and more than that, are freaked out when they learn what it does to pets and the veterans. So I think that culturally we can make inroads over time. The issue is what do you do in the immediate period? What did we do yesterday? What are we going to do on the 4th next year?
Where are most of the illegal fireworks coming from? Are Is it Mexico? Because I know there's a huge industry around fireworks there. Is that where most of this is coming from?
Well, actually, when we were growing up, that's where we would go to get firecrackers and M80s. But the stuff that you're seeing that flies and explodes, it's actually coming from within the United States for the most part. And if we talk about the enforcement thing, people think about, well, where are the police on the 4th of July? Well, in May and June and July, enforcement is actually taking place with arson units and bomb squads and so on, and undercover agencies trying to suppress the amount of fireworks that come into locales such as LA County and LA City. Through the first week in June, LA City had confiscated nearly 6,000 pounds of fireworks, which is a tremendous amount, all of it being imported through channels in the United States.
And these are legally or illegally manufactured in the U.S.?
They're legally manufactured in the United States, but they're illegal in the state of California. And then, of course, the real issue is once you've confiscated them, how do you eliminate them? Because they're explosives, and we cannot burn explosives in the state of California. So they have to be transferred to another state.
Jason and Pico Rivera said, illegal fireworks are the best kind. We're a nation of rebels, and it's a good way to celebrate. So Jason supporting the use of those fireworks. Richard in Larchmont Village, you're on Air Talk.
I live in what was originally the Hollywoodland development, you know, where the bungalows began and the mansions stop in Larchmont. And the vast majority of these structures are built of wood. Last night, there were M80s and what have you going off until the wee hours of dawn. And the fire hazard in and of itself is stultifying. I've lived here for 35 years. I'm 65 years old. I've never heard it like this before.
Richard, thanks. Appreciate it. Katie in Boyle Heights says, I have to stay home each year to protect my house, comfort my dogs. They go crazy, and it drives me crazy, too. RTB writes on the page, I spoke to a cop in Shoshone, California, near an intersection coming over from Pahrump, Nevada, where you can buy illegal fireworks, or at least illegal here. He said around the time of the 4th, they closely monitor the traffic to stop the cars from making the purchases. They look inside for obvious signs of fireworks and issue $1,000 citations. Wow, that's a disincentive. Sue in Angelino Heights in central L.A., you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. My comment is similar to Richard's in Larchmont, where we live in Angelino Heights. 95% of the structures are wooden and historic. And we've noticed an increase through the years. We've lived there for about 20 years. And it used to be like 3 days before, 3 days after, and of course on the 4th. Now it's all year round. And these M80s are going off at random times. And it's sometimes like one or two, and then you'll hear nothing for a couple days, and then they go off again. And we've asked, you know, people what to do about it. They said the police can't do anything about it. They can't track it down because it's just too random. But it's definitely increased. It's causing our animals to get out. Some people have lost their pets because of it. And there's that huge fear of, like, these wooden structures from 1880, 1890 going up in flame.
Sue, I appreciate it. Yeah, Angelino Heights, you've got those gorgeous historic L.A. homes. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it. David Barrett, Executive Officer of My Safe L.A., nonprofit that works with Los Angeles public agencies. Thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us to talk about the issue.
Of course.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I want to take a moment to thank our terrific Air Talk team, so dedicated and talented. I work with the best of the best in the business. They're led by our senior producer, Fiona Ng. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Natalie Chudnovsky, and Jonaki Mehta. Our news apprentices are Matt Bynum and Ari Saperstein. And our engineer, Parker McDaniels, Sean Corey Campbell, with us today as Parker's out ill. Film Week coming up momentarily. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. My thanks to John Horn and Stephen Cuevas, who both hosted in my absence over the past couple of weeks while I was traveling on vacation. Wonderful to be back with you. On Film Week this week, our critics Tim Cockshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, Claudia Puig, not only film critic but president of the L.A. Film Critic Association. And we begin with the Mexican film The Chambermaid from director and co-writer Lila Aviles. Her film is set in Mexico City. Gabriela Garthol is the star with Teresa Sanchez. Claudia, what'd you think of The Chambermaid?
I liked it a lot. I thought it was, it's my favorite film of the week, actually. This is a very quiet and understated observational drama. It's not just quiet, but it's patient, and it just kind of, it's beautiful to look at since a lot of it is filmed sort of steadily on a tripod. It's also very compassionate. It takes its time to sort of reveal who this character is. And, you know, they're people who are maids in hotels are people who are often unseen and ignored, and you know they're not treated well, and so it gives us a view of somebody who we normally don't see. And Aviles met and researched chambermaids working at a very luxurious hotel in Mexico City for her research, and you can tell there's these little details that just feel so real. And it's just, I love the fact that, and they also use a real actress. As opposed to, for instance, it does feel a little bit like a companion piece to Roma.
I was going to say, because it's again,
a domestic worker. Yes, right. But the difference here is that this, well, there's a lot of differences, but one difference is that Gabriela Garthol is an actress, unlike Yalitza Aparicio, who had not been an actress before. And also, there's no big epic feel, and we don't see her through the lens of privileged people. We see her, and the privileged people are in the background, who she works for. And so I think that's an interesting, it's also not, you know, Cuarón's memory, or it's not anybody's memory. It's an invented story, but there's just so much to this. There's so many layers to it. And I love her relationship with the other workers at the hotel. I just thought it was great.
And indeed, we see the world as she is seeing it. We see these guests as she sees them. It's not them gazing upon her. It's her gazing upon them. Even that window washer guy. She's watching. This director, she's fantastic. She takes her camera and she puts it on a tripod and she leaves it alone. And she lets these actors wander into this frame and play out these scenes. And it's just absolutely exquisite. Much of the film. Every now and again, we're following her. We're just over her shoulder.
Right.
And again, we're in her point of view. And I ask myself as I'm watching this film, am I like one of these guests?
I think everybody thinks
And I think to myself, am I that guy? Am I that guy? Have I done that? I think I've done that. And it makes you think to yourself, I have to be a better person.
Yes, absolutely. It does make you, you know, take stock in how you treat people that oftentimes are not seen or you know, devalued. And she gives such a nuanced and restrained performance. And she has this curiosity about how these people live, with also with a sense of like distance and deference.
But we do get inside her life a wee bit. She's taking this class. And so we can see that she wants to make herself a better person.
She's trying to get her GED. Mm-hmm. That's right. And she has a little son. And she's striving to get to work on a new floor, which will be kind of an upwardly mobile thing. And then the heartbreaking thing is that somebody left behind, one of the wealthy patrons left behind a red dress. And she goes every day to the lost of her, or frequently to the lost and found, to see, you know, if nobody claims it, then they will give it to the most worthy of the staff.
Yeah,
and so she goes, and they always say, well, you behaved really well, so you're going to get this dress. And, you know, the evolution of how she comes to deal with that is really interesting.
Yeah, I want to step back just for a moment from The Chambermaid to talk about Mexican cinema generally, because, you know, there was a period where a lot of films from Mexico were making their way up here.
Back with Amores Perros and when Iñárritu was first starting in Cuarón.
And even before that, for Spanish-speaking Angelinos, there's a huge, the movie palaces on Broadway.
Oh, way
largely,
back, absolutely.
Largely
yes.
showed Spanish-language films with big Mexican stars. And,
yes, a family friend of ours owned the Million Dollar Theater.
Oh, it was a great venue. So what's happened? I mean, I know this is a big question, but I'm assuming one of the reasons this is, you know, is getting some attention is that maybe Roma helped a little bit, you know, open.
Well, this played at Toronto. I think it might have. Yes, I'm sure it's helped now, but, you know, it was already getting attention. that's a really good question. I mean, that's happened with other cinema, like Argentine cinema was the same way for a while. I think there's an ebb and flow, you know, with foreign cinema. My frustration sometimes is that we don't see any American-born Latinos directing as much as we see a lot of Mexican directors. And, you know, not a lot. We see the big three, the three amigos.
Yeah.
And now, you know, there's a few more that are making their way. But I think it's kind of a resurgence of Mexican cinema. I mean, when you go back to like the 40s and all the actors, I mean, it was a big business. Yes, it was. Yes,
well,
it was.
Dracula, they made it in Spanish at the exact same time that they were making it in English, if you go all the way back to the 30s. It is interesting, though, those big directors, once they strike it big, they come here and they start making films in English.
Yes. That's why
European
I love Roma so much. Yeah, Europeans do it too. I mean, everybody does it, sadly. They get co-opted or they want to make the big American films, but I love that. Like,
well, they
want to
get paid.
That's
what they
want to
get.
That.
They want to get paid. The money is here.
Sure.
And
also the audiences.
Yeah.
The Chambermaid, the film from Mexico we're talking about, directed by and co-written by Lila Aviles, Juan Carlos Marquez, the co-screenwriter. The film's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal in West L.A. and Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Phil, a comedic drama directed by Greg Kinnear in his feature directorial debut. Kinnear also stars with Emily Mortimer. Stephen Mazur is the screenwriter. Tim?
Yeah, so anyway, Kinnear's directorial debut, he's a charming fellow, he is. He's very charming in this movie. This movie doesn't work at all.
Charmingly so, though.
Here he's this guy, he's divorced, he's a little depressed, perhaps a midlife crisis. He's a dentist. He runs into this man whose life seems to be absolutely perfect.
Played by Bradley Whitford.
He even has perfect teeth. I don't know why he was going to the dentist.
Did you notice that?
You know, I guess.
Yeah.
And then something happens that he witnesses. Can we say that part of the film? Because I think it's fairly obvious.
The trailer may have given it away.
Yeah. And Bradley commits suicide. He witnesses this, and it sends him into this sort of spiral. And he wants to know if this guy with his perfect life does this, then what of me? And he sort of wheedles himself into this guy's life, Emily Mortimer, his wife. And in order to do it, he has to pretend that he's Greek. There's a reason for this, except that it's a silly reason. And maybe if it were 1988, the writer of this film, a guy named Stephen Mazur, who wrote Heartbreakers and Liar Liar. And it really has a sort of like 1988, 1999 sensibility to it. But it doesn't make any sense as a contemporary film with suicide at the center of what's going on here. It wasn't funny.
No, I kind of appreciate that it was trying to take a different look at suicide and that it was trying to have sort of a darkly comic look. Because, I mean, that's been done and not enough, but not that it maybe should be done a lot. But still, I mean, I thought that was something slightly different. And sort of the comedy part is definitely in Kinnear's wheelhouse. He's so affable, as you point out. He just exudes nice guy. And so in this case, he's a little bit of a depressed but, you know, kind of reserved nice guy. And his acting is fine. I think his directing actually shows his promise. I think he could go on to, you know, do that. Unfortunately, it's all in the script, as you mentioned. Stephen Mazur's script just doesn't work. There's some really good performances, or good actors, more than performances. Emily Mortimer, Robert Forster, Bradley Whitford, we mentioned, J.D. Plass, Taylor Schilling.
It's a good cast.
It's a good cast. And there are times it works, but it feels forced and sitcom-y. And, you know, I think it was the initial idea of, like, trying to understand why somebody who seems to have it all commits suicide is something that, you know, we are all interested in. But it just goes in this really ridiculous direction.
Well, and the other thing is, if you're going to have at the center is something as tragic as suicide, not that that's off limits for humor, because tragedy can create some quite poignant humor.
Yes.
But it's hard to do. To take something as devastating as suicide and figure out how to make that darkly comedic.
Absolutely. And to have that, to take that on for your directorial debut is a really ambitious
thing to take on. Yeah. We're talking about Phil, Greg Kinnear's directorial debut. He stars with Emily Mortimer, Stephen Mazur, the screenwriter. It's rated R at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. Nick Broomfield's new documentary, Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love, looks at the relationship between Leonard Cohen, the late musician, and his Norwegian muse, Marianne Ilen, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. Broomfield always does somewhat, for lack of a better term, eccentric documentaries. I find some of his work absolutely fascinating. Other times it can be a little off-putting. So I'm curious, Claudia, about Marianne and Leonard, what you thought.
I agree with you. I really liked the Kurt and Courtney documentary. I've liked some other things he's done.
There's the Heidi Fleiss one that he did, yes, of course, years ago.
Yeah, this is not for me in the canon of On the Good Side. He's a personal filmmaker. He injects himself into films, into his documentaries, and he does it here in a way that I found really distasteful. Marianne is Leonard's muse. They met when they're very young. They live in this beautiful Greek island that's very idyllic. He had some he basically comes out and says, you know, I slept with her too. And it just felt like, why?
Nick Broomfield?
Yes. And so are you trying to equate yourself with Leonard Cohen? I don't know what the point of all this is. And just the whole notion of her, you know, the title is Marianne and Leonard. We don't find out that much about Leonard Cohen because a lot of stuff has been done on Leonard Cohen, so you don't learn anything particularly new. There's some good footage, but you find out next to nothing about Marianne. And she's supposed to be his muse, which is always kind of a problematic notion anyway.
He wrote a song for her.
He wrote one song for her. It was like, Goodbye, Marianne. Yeah. Or, you know, So Long, Marianne.
Not a very good song.
Not a good song. It wasn't Suzanne. But still, he writes a song, and then she's a cipher. And then the one thing we do find out is that, you know, okay, yeah, he does a lot of drugs. He womanizes like crazy. And the real victims in all of this, I mean, she is, you know, besotted with him. She's not there for her son. He doesn't care about kids. So this poor son that she has, she was a single mom, just falls by the wayside and ends up in a mental institution. He's completely damaged by, you know, living with these drug-addled or whatever people.
That's a sodomite. Yeah. On this island in Greece. And much of it takes place there. A good chunk of this begins in the early 60s when she was his muse. She had been married before, already had a son. Lovely. Norwegian.
Beautiful little boy.
This beautiful little boy, and he comes into their life. He's sort of a father figure for the boy, but he's wandering in and out of this woman's life. He'll go off and write a book, come to the United States, do this and stuff, and wandering in and out of this child's life.
She wanders in and out of his life, too.
Yes, everybody's taking lovers and all of this kind of stuff that's going on inside. It's all just a mess and a nightmare.
In this beautiful, idyllic place.
Broomfield does not seem to know this as he's looking. He cannot seem to see all of the narcissism that is at work among these people. And to the extent, I mean, Marianne, this movie, no, they should have just called it, at a minimum, call it Leonard and Marianne, because it's mostly about him.
Yeah.
But mostly it's just about him.
It's about him. Yeah. Understandably, he's the famous one, but then don't call it Marianne and Leonard. And not only was this child kind of a victim, but all the children who lived on the island. Yeah. I mean, it just broke my heart. And it was such an afterthought, the way it was sort of just dismissed. It's like, kid ended up completely addicted and in a mental hospital. Yeah. I just felt like it all felt very sort of superficial, and then you could tell that he was just caught up.
They wrote a couple of lovely letters to each other, and ultimately, I think he passed away about 3 or 4 months after her.
Very shortly afterwards. Yeah, it doesn't give you any kind of illumination into Leonard Cohen's mind at all, and certainly none into Marianne's.
Look, when it comes to Leonard Cohen, I like the one song,
Hallelujah. Yeah, that's it.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Marianne and Leonard, Words of Love documentary from Nick Broomfield. It's rated R at the Landmark in West L.A. and the ArcLight Hollywood. Escape Plan: The Extractors. John Hertzfeld is the director. Mike Chapman, screenwriter. Sylvester Stallone, Dave Bautista, and Curtis 50 Cent Jack. And star Tim, give us the 1 minute version.
Yeah, 50 Cent Jack. John Hertzfeld wrote 2 Days in the Valley, by the way, wrote and directed 2 Days in the Valley. Yeah, that's who he is. This movie's terrible. Yeah, there it is, right? Third one of these movies. And
tell us what you really think.
This is why it's there. First one of these movies, Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. That movie cost $50 million, made $25 million domestic, but made $130 million worldwide. Thus, there's another one of these movies, and thus there's a third. These people have figured out a little industry, and that's the reason why these movies exist. It's not that they're wonderfully cinematic. This one is for the Hong Kong market. This is not about Sylvester Stallone or even 50 Cent at all. This is about the Hong Kong market. That's what's going on in this movie. And I think that we'll probably see 3 or 4 more of these before they go away.
All right. Escape Plan, The Extractors, the film from John Hertzfeld and screenwriter Mike Chapman, starring Sylvester Stallone, Dave Bautista, Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. Rated R, and it's available on demand. Back with more in a minute. Next up on Film Week with Claudia Puig and Tim Cockshell as our critics, we revisit a couple of films that were reviewed on last week's program. They opened in wide release earlier this week, but we want to come back, case you to want to see them this weekend. Spider-Man Far From Home, directed by John Watts, written by Chris McKenna and Eric Summers. Tom Holland, Samuel L. Jackson, and Zendaya star in the film with Jake Gyllenhaal. Tim, what do you think of this latest Spider-Man?
It's an affable film. It's a good film. It's a pivot film is what it is. This is a film that allows them to pivot that franchise away from all of the events of Endgame. It's post-Endgame. All of that stuff happened, and now we can go off in a different direction. It's lighter. Has a good deal more in common with Guardians of the Galaxy or even the one of the Deadpool films, that's been like, just in terms of tone. But we still have these characters that we know that are pushing toward a much the entire universe is not at stake in this film. Mostly it's just Peter Parker's vacation that's at stake in this film. He wants to go to Europe and hang out with his friends. Nick Fury wants him, to take on the mantle of Spider-Man. So he has to figure out a way to do both. Love me some Zendaya. She is absolutely extraordinary, just as a young actress. Best thing in that P.T. Barnum movie. She's on a series called Euphoria now. I've been interviewing her since she was a little kid. I used to interview her when she was a Disney kid.
Wow.
So she's fantastic. But you know what she's not? Mary Jane. She's not. Mary Jane is a lovely little redhead, always has been, and always should be. I'm sorry, I'm a stickler about that. so that's a thing for me. My favorite Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire's original. My favorite Spider-Man, 1960s, the one you and I grew up watching.
Right.
Larry, Spider-Man. That's my Spider-Man.
I want to hear Larry sing.
Yeah, right.
But if it's got to be a human Spider-Man, I thoroughly enjoyed the original Tobey Maguire Spider-Man with Kirsten Dunst, and that's my Spider-Man. Yeah. And I've never really needed another one.
That's Sam Raimi, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the new one, Spider-Man Far From Home, John Watts, the director, rated PG-13 in wide release. Also, the horror film Midsommar from writer-director Ari Aster, Florence Pugh, Will Poulter, and Jack Rayner star in the horror film. Claudia?
I really like this film. It falls into this kind of folk horror, this kind of...
like the Wicker Man kind of thing?
Yes, it is very much like that. Yeah, and it has, a lot of people have made those comparisons. It has this spooky but kind of queasy, unsettling quality to it. Ari Aster, who of course did Hereditary, is a very talented filmmaker, I think, and he's pretty ingenious in terms of plot lines. This is just sinister. It's a tiny bit uneven, but it's very watchable, and the premise of it is just, you know, a young woman who we completely are on her side. She's had this terrible tragedy happen to her, played by Florence Pugh, and she's great. Every little detail of her face. She's had a terrible family tragedy, and she has this kind of rotten boyfriend, and he's going to Sweden with his bros, and he kind of very haphazardly invites her along, more out of guilt than anything else. And she says yes. He's expecting her to say no, and invites her to go on this trip to Sweden. And so they go to this strange commune with these kind of seemingly flower in their hair hippie type people, but they're not. Yeah. They are anything but gentle people. It unravels in a pretty creepy way. I mean, it's not. I didn't find it to be like one of those horror films where you're on the edge of your seat so much as you are just deeply unnerved.
Mm. You know, it's funny reading the description of it. It sounded kind of absurd, you know, reading it. And then I've seen the reviews. I mean, extraordinary, 90-some% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
You know, he must have taken this sort of absurd premise and really made everybody buy into it.
He does. And you almost believe this place exists. I mean, I don't know what it is, how he creates it in such a way that you believe that this weird cult and this place exists. There's nothing about it that feels all that fantasy-like.
Yeah. This event that only happens every 90 years, you know, this thing that they're going to be doing in this this cultural thing. And so Ari Aster, I appreciate more than I like. Hereditary, I appreciate more than I actually like. Wicker Man, yes, but the 1973 Wicker Man, nutty thing.
Yeah.
Anthony
original
Schaefer,
one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Who wrote Frenzy and Sleuth, by the way, Anthony Schaefer. Mm. Edward Woodard in that film. So this movie, there's a moment in this movie where something happens. And I'm gonna take this from a generally speaking racial point of view. I'm sitting here watching this movie, and I'm thinking to myself, no black people stay in this movie after that happens. none that I know anyway. Not from St. Louis.
I think you're talking about one of the parts for me. It was like, really? Like,
yes.
People of color do try to take off afterwards, and then one guy sticks around.
All my homies are like, you know what, guys? This is a wonderful thing. I'm out of here, and the movie's over. But everybody sticks around and the rest of the movie happens. So, you know, but that's where I live in that movie. All I know is I would have never seen the end of it.
No, I agree with you. But what I like is that this is bright and sunshine. It's a bright, sunshiny tale of dread. And the contrast of this bucolic place with its kind of summer camp feel with this absolutely horrible, sinister stuff that's going. I love that sort of contradiction.
Yeah. And Astor's previous film was
Hereditary.
Yeah. which got
great
wonderful
reviews, too.
Reviews.
I like this one better, actually.
Again, that's one that I appreciate more than I actually like.
Yeah.
We're talking about Midsommar, which actually opened earlier this week, and we're revisiting it, so you can decide whether you want to see it this weekend. Ari Aster, the writer-director, it's rated R in wide release. The thriller Skin in the Game is directed by Adisa. I just have Adisa.
That's it.
Like Madonna.
Yeah.
Yes. Or Zendaya.
Yeah.
Skin in the Game's written by Stephen Palmer Peterson. Claudia?
Well, this is I don't know. This feels a bit amateurish overall. Only one actor, and that's Erica Ash, does a good job acting.
The lead.
Yes. And she's a former sex worker. It's all very convenient because this young girl, young blonde teenage girl, is sort of snatched off the streets to become and kidnapped. And not to in any way diminish the fact that, you know, human trafficking is a terrible, terrible thing and it is on the rise. But she's snatched away, and the only person who can kind of help track her down happens to be the mom's former best friend of the godmother, who had been a sex worker, and that's this actress. It's contrived already. Mm. And there's a couple lines about Studio City and Ventura Boulevard sort of subbing in for the inner city that are really funny and laughable. But yes, it condemns, of course, this exploitation, but it also kind of is sensationalistic.
Come on, man. You can't look, these movies, these guys, they try to get away with this thing, and they put up these, you know, human sex trafficking is this thing, and then they show us all these really salacious scenes
very
of these
salacious
young women in these little bitty outfits and all of this sort of
horrible hairy men these little glamorous women
it's Grindhouse meets PSA
with a bunch of bad dialogue shoved into these actresses'
terrible
mouths where everybody gets to tell the little terrible story or whatever. I'm like, this is just no.
Skin in the Game is the film. It stars Erica Ash. It's at the AMC City Walk in Universal City and select a video on demand platforms. Coming up a little bit later, it's your chance to ask questions of our critics. We haven't done this in a very long time. Just opened up our phone lines or our Film Week page for you to ask questions. If you're with us for the live Friday broadcast of Film Week, you'll have a chance to call in and ask our critics questions about their work or about film generally. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722 for the live Friday Film Week. Next, we talk about the re-release of the 1982 favorite, The Return of Martin Guerre, the film directed by Daniel Vignier. The film Unrated, Gérard Depardieu stars in the film with Natalie Bai. Tim, take us back to 82 in this film, which was extremely popular.
Very popular. Saw it in 1982.
Me too.
It was beautiful then. This restoration is extraordinary. Just absolutely pristine in every possible way. I just thoroughly love just looking at this film.
It's so beautiful.
A reminder, even if you know the story, it's a reminder of just what a wonderful... So I'm on the edge of my seat. I've seen this movie a dozen times, surely. I'm nevertheless on the edge of my seat. Gérard Depardieu. I had forgotten how ridiculously handsome he was.
He really was. I'd forgotten, too.
That jaw, that...
Such a great actor.
So the story, we meet this couple when they're getting married, medieval France. They get married. There's some issues. Early in their married life, he goes away and is gone for 10 years
to fight in the Hundred Years' War.
So they
say.
And then a man returns. The man who returns is Gérard Depardieu. And the question is he in fact
Martin Guerre.
Yeah. And it's just a wonderful thing. The wonderful trial. The costumes are extraordinary, particularly in this restoration, because it's also bright and vibrant. And Gerard Depardieu's face, he can do things with his face that the great comedic, particularly French actors, can do. There's a scene near the end of this movie where he has to look at Natalie Bai and he has to communicate what he needs to communicate just with his face. He goes through this little litany of expressions that just break you in half. It's just extraordinary. It's just so wonderful.
And Natalie Bai, too. I mean, she communicates so much. She's, I think, in a way, it's almost her movie, too, because it's she's the one that, you know, is whoever this guy is, whether he's the original, her husband, or he's a wonderful person to her. Mm. The other one was not a great husband or father or human. So, you know, is she falling in love with this new person? Is he the original person? All of that. It's so superbly acted. And it's kind of about acting because he's acting the role of Martin Guerre, too. So I love that it kind of goes from being this period folktale, and then it's a mystery, then it's a courtroom drama, you know, the medieval courtroom drama. And it just evokes that era and that countryside so well. It was so much fun seeing it again. I hadn't seen it since 1982.
It's a 30-year-old movie based on a 40-year-old book. So, you know, it ends very darkly, but somehow it's still beautiful.
Oh, absolutely.
I hate to say it's a 37.
37, oh. Yes.
I'm sorry.
We saw it when we were just
how
born,
much
right?
Time has passed. The Return of Martin Guerre.
It's a toddler movie.
It's unrated. Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Very rare for a documentary to get a re-release, but Paris is Burning had such a wonderful reception back in 90 or 92 that it came out?
1990, yeah.
And it was the New York City drag scene. And ballrooms and all, Paris is Burning. I just remember back at that time when our critics reviewed it, how much they loved this movie. It's out again, Claudia.
And we will love it again. It introduced us to this cast of characters that had this, you know, this safe space coming together. It feels like it was the precursor to where we are now. It was so kind of ahead of its time. And, you know, now you have RuPaul's Drag Race and all that, but this kind of...
It's so mainstream.
Yes, yeah, so mainstream, but this was not. Yeah. And you know, about the drag balls of Harlem, it's both kind of this celebration and it's also this commentary. And I love that the focus was on Black and Latino, gay and transgender folks. The way she looks at the subculture and just lets them tell their own stories, I think is just so wonderful and so powerful and still holds up so well.
Yeah, Jenny Livingston, the director of this film, who's gone on to make other films, including a series called Pose, which sort of takes from this. Of course, Madonna's record Vogue came out and was deeply influenced by all of this. And when you look at some of those women in that video from back in the day, keep in mind that not all of them are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're talking about Paris is Burning, the documentary from 1990 by Jenny Livingston, which was her directorial debut,
yes.
By the way. What a way to debut.
And she gained such intimate access to these dance clubs and people really spoke to her, you know, so openly. And I was really taken by it. I hadn't seen it way back when it first came out. So it's revelatory.
It's rated R. You can see it at the New Art Theater in West L.A. We have a couple more films to talk about when we come back, but I want to take your calls. You can ask our critics. Let Tim and Claudia answer any question you have about state of film today. It can be about the kind of work that they do. I have my own questions for them. I'll intersperse as well. If you're listening to Live Friday Film Week, you can call us at 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. We have another film to review, Cold Blood, which is a French mystery thriller, which stars Jean Reno and Sarah Ling. Tim, what do you think of Cold Blood?
That's funny. It's not much of a mystery, and it's not particularly thrilling.
No.
this movie, Jean Reno plays a hitman, surprise, surprise, who has sequestered himself out in the deep north. Right,
it's supposed to be Washington State. It's at the Carpathian Mountains in the Ukraine.
You're way out there, it's nothing. A young woman on a snow. What do you call those
mobile.
Things? Mobile has an accident, not terribly far from him. He has to decide whether he's going to help her because he's sequestered himself for a reason. Now, what's going on here is so insanely obvious that the word mystery really does not apply.
We figure it out in five seconds.
In five seconds, we know exactly why she's there. And then this whole story is explained to us, and I mean explained to us, by this these cops, this old cop, exactly what's going on. They tell us who everybody is, what they did, what it, because you know what? We don't have any money to actually shoot these scenes. So we're just going to have these guys sit in this really fancy police department and explain what's going on. And every now and again, we cut back out to the cabin.
Yes, and then there's all these people that are supposed to be very American from New York, and they all have these vague European accents. It's like, that's not a New York accent.
That's one of the notion of an American accent. Here's the thing, folks. There's no such thing as an American accent. There are American accents. It depends on where you're
country.
From. Well, yeah.
And at one point, somebody goes, do you have that in New York? And the other person goes, what? He goes, Netflix. And he goes, believe me, New York Homicide, you don't need Netflix.
No,
I mean, the dialogue is
so bad. Terrible, so
yeah.
Terrible. So, you know, anyway, what are you going to do?
Oh, my. Cold Blood is the film written and directed by Frédéric Petitjean. It's unrated at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Anime Expo is back at the L.A. Convention Center through Sunday, so who better than KPCC Film Week critic Charles Solomon to preview what's going on at the Convention Center. Charles, thanks for being with us. What are some of the highlights you want to steer us toward?
Hi, Larry. I'm down here on the Convention Center floor. There are thousands of people here with me. A lot of people are excited about a new film, Promare. That's from the people who did Gurren Lagann. It's got an amazing design sense, a fantastically flamboyant panel, and a plot that rambles along like a skateboarder on Lombard Street. There's also Otomo, Katsuya Otomo, the creator of Akira, announced his new project yesterday that includes a new science fiction film and another animated version of Akira. And then at 4:30 on Saturday, I'll be doing a Q&A with Yuichiro Saito, the producer of Mirai of the Future and the other films of Mamoru Hosoda.
All right. All right. That sounds great. You were going to say something else. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say what makes this event so much fun is that it's the most inclusive thing you will find. It doesn't matter your age, your gender, your weight, your identity. Anything. If you love My Hero Academia and Naruto and Sailor Moon, come on now, because you've got friends here, and you know, you'll just be part of a tribe.
So is this at all reminiscent of Comic-Con, the huge San Diego event?
It's more like what Comic-Con used to be and should still be. It's by and for the fans. It's not about the big commercial studio releases and publicity and so forth. This is the chance to put on your costume, you know, look for a disc you don't have or a manga you've been searching for, and just talk to people who love the same things you do.
All right, Charles, thanks so much. He's with us live from Anime Expo at the L.A. Convention Center through this Sunday. KPCC critic Charles Solomon joining us. Claudia Puig, Tim Cogshell, our Film Week critics. And again, if you're listening live Friday, we're at 866-893-KPCC. And by the way, Anime Expo, you can get more information by visiting our Film Week page. We've got a link to the info on that at kpcc.org. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with this week's critics, Tim Cogshell and Claudia Puig. And it's time to ask the critics. Chance for you to call in if you're listening to the Friday live show, 866-893-KPCC. And if you're listening to the Saturday noon broadcast, you can put your question on our Film Week page, and I'll make sure it gets asked on a future program. That's at kpcc.org. Cheryl in Hawthorne, your question for our critics. Cheryl, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go right ahead. Your question for our critics.
Yes. Since you obviously get to see these films before they're released to the public, where do you screen them? Do you get to screen them in a large screen theater or on small screens or what?
Claudia?
Generally, we do screen them on in theaters. Mm-hmm. And if they're big studio releases, always in theaters. Mm-hmm. If they're smaller independent films, you know, more and more we're starting to see them on links, especially if there's something that is going to be on Netflix, because it's sort of, you know, more appropriate to be seeing it the way other people are going to be seeing it, mm-hmm. as well. But yeah, we see them at sometimes at the studio screening rooms, sometimes at theaters where they hold early screenings. Those are the main two. And sometimes at private screening rooms.
Yeah, sometimes private screening
sometimes
rooms.
One of the problems with those links that you're describing is they have a watermark to make sure, you know, to show that this is not to be pirated, of course. And it can be very distracting when you're trying to watch the film and there's some sort of a watermark that takes up part of the picture.
Yes.
It really
and it has your
me.
Name on it.
Yeah.
And it's your,
it has your name and it
across
has
someone's face.
Some ID number that goes with your name.
And if you're reading subtitles, all the more. It's even, it's very distracting.
A lot of stuff can be happening sometimes. And every now and again, so a film that we talked about today, The Chambermaid, a small, intimate film, yet I would still recommend seeing that film in a theater.
Yes.
Because it is such a beautifully composed film. Not a lot of big action, no car chases or shootouts, but so beautifully composed in the way that Roma was.
Yes. Definitely. That needed to be seen on a big
scale.
Big
scale would
screen.
Be an extraordinary thing.
And of course, Return of Martin Guerre with its restoration should be seen on a big screen. I mean, ideally, we would see everything on a big screen. I still feel that most, 99.9% of things need to be seen on a big screen. Mm.
Guzzle in Pasadena said, how do you pick which films you're going to review? He said, I'm from India. I don't often hear about Southeast Asian films on the program. Is that because they're not released locally? I want to know about that selection process.
Well, it does begin with films being made available for us to review in time for the show.
So you're not going to review something that's only shown in another country.
Exactly. A film needs to be made available. We are having discussions about films that are films need to be theatrically released. We do have a conversation now about films that are day and date, theatrically released and streaming on
services.
A platform on the same day.
Yeah.
Occasionally, we will run into a film that has already been on a streaming service but does get a theatrical release. And I feel like we just see them all.
The world is kind of changing, I think, but there are some South Asian films and Indian films that are released. But if it screens in one theater, we pretty much will see it.
Yeah.
All right. Again, if you're listening to our Friday live broadcast of Film Week, you can call in with your question for our critics. You can ask them about how they do their work, their views on the evolution of film. Pretty much wide open. The topic you choose, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. You can also ask a question on the Film Week page, and even on Saturday you can do that, and I'll ask it on a future segment of the program. Pippi says... Tim, on January 17th, 2014,
oh my gosh.
On the segment Actors Under 40 to Watch, you know where this is going, Tim, you dismissed Benedict Cumberbatch as nothing more than a pretty face.
Yeah.
Given his success in The Imitation Game, The Hollow Crown, Hamlet, and Sherlock, among others, has your opinion changed?
Well, the very handsome young man became a better actor. What can I say about that? And he is a pretty face. He still is. But yeah, no, Benedict has become an extraordinary actor, much better. He was not good in August Osage County. He did not execute that Southern accent properly.
Yes,
so
that's true.
He is fallible, but I appreciate Benedict quite a lot. And that is really weird that you remember that, by the way.
I'm impressed you remember from 5.5 years ago what you said about Benedict Cumberbatch. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with Claudia Puig, Tim Cogshell, and a reminder to join us for our next Film Week screening of Boogie Nights. On the screen of the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday night, July 27th. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. We'll take more of your calls in a minute. We'll talk with listeners momentarily, get their questions for the critics, Tim Cogshell and Claudia Puig with us on Film Week. But I have a question for the two of you. Many times we'll get approached by... publicity companies for films, and they want to know if I want to interview someone involved with it. And so I'll typically watch, see if I connect with the film personally to decide if I do want to do the interview. Because if I don't like it, it doesn't make sense to do it. I feel like I can tell within about 15, 20 minutes of a movie whether I like it, whether I think it's a quality film. Now, some might feel that's very unfair because there are slow-starting films that later really deliver. Tim, my question for you is, at what point typically do you think you can tell what you think of a film?
And just because I decide that I can tell doesn't mean that I won't continue to watch it anyway.
With an open mind.
Mm-hmm. With an open mind. But I'm about a 10-minute guy.
Okay.
I'm about a 20-minute person. Yeah. But my theory is things can start good and go down. Mm-hmm. They rarely start bad and get better.
Yeah.
Amen. That is so true. I'm trying to think of a film that I just really disliked 15 minutes in, that by the end, wow, that delivered.
Yes,
and,
doesn't happen.
Yeah, as opposed to, ambivalent about 15 or 10 minutes in, which is a different sort of
thing. But if you hate it pretty much in the beginning, you're going to,
If you feel like this is just improbable, the script doesn't make, no one would really say this.
Yeah,
it's pretty clear.
It doesn't get better.
It doesn't. Again, if you're listening on our Friday Film Week, it's live, a chance for you to call and ask our critics your question at 866-893-KPECC. You can also post your question on our Film Week page either Friday or Saturday at kpecc.org. Ralph asks, I'm wondering if each of you could tell us about a film in which your view of it did a complete 180. For example, many critics initially hated Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde. Many others were ambivalent about Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, both films now considered classics. Claudia?
I was thinking in the other direction. I remember being charmed by Forrest Gump and then afterwards thinking this was not a good movie. I'm trying to think if I have one that I really didn't like and then thought differently about. I'm not thinking of one.
Well, Eyes Wide Shut. I remember being really irritated by Eyes Wide Shut for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah, me too. I will remain irritated.
It's an extraordinary film to look at. Sidney Pollack's performance in that film is really,
terrific.
Really good.
Pollack is, to me, a very underrated
actor. Yes.
Almost everything I saw him in. It's like,
because he's such a good director. Everybody focused on that.
It's almost too, it'd be better if there were two Sidney Pollacks. It could have been a full-time actor and full-time director.
Tootsie, are you kidding me? He's fantastic in Tootsie. Yeah. So there are films like that. Sometimes it comes with an understanding that comes late of what that film was about. You have one of those, oh my goodness, I completely missed what that movie was about. And once you understand what the movie is about, you reevaluate.
Was that your Eyes Wide Shut experience?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that movie was about. I thought it was just a movie about the upper echelon of society and the games that they play. No, that movie is about something else altogether. It's about identity. That movie is about Nicole Kidman's identity as filtered through the gaze of all of these men and the ideas about who she was supposed to be. And that made me think of
that
movie.
Well, now I got to relook at it after that analysis.
Yes.
I guess I do too, but I don't want to.
A lot of Lars von Trier films,
I was just going to say Lars von Trier.
I got to come at Lars two or three times.
Because there are some that I really like, but there are some that I, like Antichrist, that I absolutely despise.
Yeah.
And I almost want to see the ones that I despise again just to kind of... Or Nymphomaniac a little bit, although there was
a
moment.
I love the Nymphomaniac.
There was one part. It was in two parts. I think the first part I liked better than the second. But I kind of feel like I want to go back. Those are the ones that have so many layers, and also
Breaking the Waves.
I love Breaking the Waves. Synecdoche, New York. I want to go back. I mean Charlie Kaufman.
There's
some. Now I actually like that first time out, but
I did
I'm
not.
A big Charlie Kaufman.
Me too.
Fan.
Me too. I'm a huge fan. Yeah.
Joey in Fullerton, your question for our critics.
Sure. Yeah. Hi. My question is, how do you keep track of all your content and your ideas that you're going to write after you see the movie while you're watching the movie, and so that you don't disturb others, that you take notes? How do you put them on your phone? How do you keep track? Because then you write a column.
Yeah, it's such a good question. Or are you training memory to sort of tag things mentally to do it? Claudia, how do you
think? Tried different ways. I'm an inveterate note taker. It goes back to college. I'm one of those people that was always taking copious notes. When people talk to me on the phone, I would be taking notes. So I just always took notes for years and years and years, quietly, not on my phone, not so that it would disturb anybody, just writing, you know, the old-fashioned way with a notepad and a pen and, you know, with my fingers sort of at a point where I would know not to write on top of what I wrote before because it's dark, like little dumb things that you learn to do.
Almost like stenography.
Yeah, almost like stenography. The problem is my writing can be so terrible that I have to decipher
then
it
you
afterwards.
Can't figure it.
Yes.
That's my problem. When I've taken notes at a screening, I can't read my notes afterwards.
So I have to do it right away. The other thing I've tried to do is just sit and watch and let it wash over me.
Yeah.
And I still have not yet figured out. I do both. And it just depends on the movie. And sometimes I might go back and see it again.
I gave up on all of that a long time ago. Our one-time film week colleague, Andy Klein, used to have this device to use.
Oh, Joe Morgenstern has one of those, too.
And he would sit there and type these notes, and he would cover the little glowing screen. And apparently he was just a really good typist, because I would sit next to Andy, and he'd be sitting there typing these notes as he watched
the
movie.
It's like a court reporter watching the movie.
He was basically writing his review as he wrote the movie. I don't do anything anymore. I just watch the movie.
Destin in Burbank wonders about your turnaround time. After you see a movie, how quickly do you write the full review?
Well, when I was working for Box Office Magazine for 17 years, very often we had to turn in the review the very next morning. Sometimes we would be writing to a deadline that evening. So I could turn a overnight, unequivocally, I could turn a review around. Now, we had really great editors. Wade Major was one of my editors.
Yeah.
Thank God for Wade. very often I would turn a review. But you know what? Not a good idea.
Not the best. I always like having a little bit of time. But when I was at USA Today for 18 years, it's funny, we're both the same amount of time. The same thing. I mean, sometimes, you know, they would wait until the very last. But generally, it wouldn't be the night before. It might be two nights before. But it might be Wednesday night, it was due on Thursday, so yes, it would be the night before. And sometimes they show it to you months in advance, and then I would just, you know, I'd have time to sort of think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I like having time to think about it.
I was going to say, does that help to let a film, some movies kind of percolate before you write
some movies you really need to percolate, and sometimes you don't have that luxury.
I rewrote my review of Unforgiven four times. Because I saw it in such a long lead screening.
Wow.
And it was all about emphasis, about what I wanted the review to emphasize. You know,
because there are a lot of things you could choose in that film.
It's a great film.
Yeah. All right. What do you think of Rotten Tomatoes? David in the Fairfax District.
Oh, I have strong feelings. I think it's very reductive. It's very binary, the whole fresh rotten thing. I understand why people turn to it as a tool, but I think here's why it's so problematic. You could have a movie that everybody thinks is slightly better, like a little more good than bad. So if everybody thinks a movie is a little more good than bad, so everybody gives it what would be a fresh review, that could come out to like 98%. But it could really just be sort of like, that's okay.
Yeah.
So that it's very misleading.
Or vice versa. It also undermines the notion of reading thoughtful reviews, actually reading the thoughtful review. Siskel and Ebert did the thumbs up, thumbs down thing, but they did it after they talked about the movie.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. Michael in Irvine, is being a film critic a full-time 40-hour-a-week job? Real quickly, Tim.
Not anymore.
It can be. Depends on who you work for.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
The flip side, when you two or any of our critics are coming on Film Week in a week, how many hours with all these films?
Well, if we're watching 8 to 10 films, that's 2 hours of film.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you count the, you know,
all the notes,
all the notes, the prep you do. Yeah.
You may look up about the director, previous stuff. Yeah, it's more than full time those weeks.
Yes, it is.
All right. Thanks so much, Tim. Claudia, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us for another Film Week on KPCC. Have a wonderful weekend.